Can you all hear me? You can hear me. Great. Thanks to Dirk for the kind introduction. And yes, it's true. I have a talk, and I assure you there was more work than whipping together the slides that I usually have. And that has to do with the fact that Uwe sorted me into this particular set of questions. And I said, this is fine. I'll have my revenge later. And as a sort of kind of a side, I'll do what is a time-honored tradition of doing something a little bit else than what the organizer has asked me to do. My apologies to them. Also, my apologies to the two co-panelists. I'm really looking forward to the discussion. What I will say is might look or sound a little bit orthogonal to what you all have in mind after reading the title, but it may be at least a good contrapunct and maybe also a good preparation for what follows. Now, I am not the director of that institute, and I also, but I do have a tie. You may have seen that on the photo, right? So I didn't bring that. And I will also protest a little bit to the new role of the state in the title of the conference, because there might be many new roles that the state can play. In order to allow the state to play the roles that we think of as being beneficial, we may want to do a little bit about how the state approaches that. And that's why the subtitle of what I will be talking about is Toward Agile Innovation Policies, because the past years, now roughly 15 years that I've been active, not just in research, but also in sort of consulting policymakers, the greatest source of sometimes frustration, sometimes academic excitement has been the apparent slowness of the process by which we arrive at outcomes or do not arrive at outcomes. Slowness is not just, in that case, a German phenomenon. I observe that in other countries as well. And I have done a hidden micro-survey with some of my colleagues who shared that sentiments. So before we have this other debate on what the state should do and what it rather should not do, we may want to take stock of what the state can do at this point and how we can sort of expand the set of things that the state can do. And I think we can learn from some other fields on that. So I want to discuss of what limits and of what enables these public organizations and what will be needed to extend the abilities in such ways that is deemed productive. Or that they at least can do what they have promised to do, because there's also public pressure to promise a lot. In Germany, that comes usually in coalition negotiation rounds every 4 years or something like that. There's a paper that promises what will happen in the next 4 years. And of course, that is programmatic then. That is the agenda that needs to be fulfilled. This approach of talking about the micro issue of how we can do things might not be the entirely German or Prussian approach. We're in Hanover, so this is Prussian heartland. And the question is, of course, justified. Should we not talk about the lofty objectives, the goals, the visions first, and develop the capabilities for doing that later? That's a perfectly reasonable argument. In principle, you should say yes. But I think what has happened in the past years is that we have talked policymakers into doing a lot of things, also from the academic sector, and the capabilities have been somewhat neglected. So I think it's a good point for this discussion. A second argument for thinking about how things can be done is the current ferment and speed of change. As I will argue later, the predictive, the strategic, the analytic mode of policy development may run into a stone wall when technical and societally changes come extremely quickly. So I think that digital transformation is such a context where things are happening extremely quickly. If you look at the AI discussion, the blockchain discussions, and so forth, those are other contexts that favor a more adaptive and agile approach. Environmental challenges may be conducive to other modes, and that raises the specter that the public sector organizations we're talking about need to do something that is called ambidexterity. Many of you are familiar with what Chuck O'Reilly and other organizational researchers have advocated to private sector companies to be sort of well-versed in an exploitative mode as well as an exploratory mode, and that figures into what I'll be telling you about that. So, the most important claim of what follows, so listen to the next 30 seconds and then you can forgo the rest and tune in later if you want. The most important claim of what follows is this. that current structures, processes, and cultures in these organizations or sub-organizations that deal with research and innovation policies, organizations that are charged with the development and implementation of R&D policies, are outdated and often dysfunctional. And they stand in the way more than they advance what is supposed to be done. So let me elaborate a little bit on that. If that is true, then innovation is needed, not just as an objective of what these organizations do, but in the very activity of research and innovation policy making itself. Or to be more precise, it's not product innovation, new subsidy programs, new policy initiatives, new instruments that I'm talking about. It's novel processes, novel organizations, modes of operation, value models in the public sector organizations. And that's why I'm here. In my view, this problem is currently more pressing than having another round of the government versus market debate, as important as it may be. So let me outline a few thoughts in a sequence of steps, which hopefully build on each other and are reasonably coherent. My apologies that they're not. Let me first rebut something that I consider a very unhelpful stereotype when we talk about state versus market or state versus private actors. And that is that we have bureaucratic, non-professional, slow processes on the one hand that are due to less capable individuals. I don't think that that's true. So I don't have survey evidence or other large-scale statistics, but in my experience, that is simply not true. If we have bureaucratic, non-professional, slow processes, I think they are mostly the consequence of the lack of appropriate organizational structures, processes, and a decoupling of progress that happens in these fields. If you look I used to teach before I joined Max Planck in a department at a business school. So I looked into at least 3-4 companies in depth, 2-3-day excursion tours for each of the companies every year. And you saw the change. Organizations changed. 25 years ago, there might have been excitement about matrix organizations. And then at some point, cross-functional teams came in. Tell me the public sector organization that has cross-functional teams. Some do, but very few. Okay? So what I'm trying to tell you is that the times have changed, the outside, the challenge. Internal organizations in other sectors of the economy have changed, but very little in the public sector has changed. And innovation of a particular type, organizational innovation, new structures, new processes have not come in. Private organizations have seen that, and that, of course, also leads to an increasing decoupling or lack of common language when these two sectors meet or when managers come up to a ministry, meet there, and so forth. So that raises the real danger that public sector organizations in particular fields, and certainly not all of them, I don't want to overgeneralize, okay, have petrified, have become dysfunctional, when it comes to execute plans with novel elements swiftly and precisely. And that stands in the way of innovation. So, moreover, and now I'm sort of alerting you to the bad guy out there, public sector organizations have willingly or in sort of a slow downhill, slippery slope sliding process caved in to the demand of an all-encompassing controlling logic. That was the bad guy. Which seeks to constrain state employees. Employees are asked, for example, to refrain from excessive travel. You may think travel is good for collecting information if you want to know what's going on in other countries, or if you want to go to the Hanover Fair and see lots of companies in one bunch coming together. That's a very efficient and effective way of collecting information. Well, you may not see many folks from these public sector organizations there, simply because there might be restrictions. And of course, there are process restrictions. You cannot simply veer off the beaten path, which some people think is important for innovation and for coming up with unexpected results. Let's talk a little bit about the controlling logic, because I find that utterly fascinating. Controlling has had a devastating effect. And to understand that, consider two types of projects. Project A. Project A is what I would call an investment project. The project steps are clearly delineated. The necessary steps are clear. There's no uncertainty regarding the desired outcomes. Prediction is utterly without danger. the world is almost deterministic. Okay, we can do prediction in this world and predictions are fine. And the rest is then capable management, right? The expected return conditional on capable management is known. So simple application of Bayes' rule or some household wisdom statistic would tell you that if success has not come about, management must have been lousy, because everything was predictable and all we needed to come to success was capable management. That's an investment project. And that's the logic that the controller in a corporation or in a public sector organization that believes in the investment logic will apply. Something went wrong, bad management. So that creates incentive structures for everybody involved, okay? In other words, if the results are not according to expectations, then management must have been at fault. This logic is pervasive, also at the country level. I have to tell you that I think that this is essentially the intellectual foundation of German insolvency laws. In Germany and in other countries, if you go into insolvency, the conclusion is must have been really bad or has mishandled money. The conclusion is not necessarily it was a risky project and it was good that it was undertaken. So the public penalization of failed entrepreneurs is a shaming and punishing exercise. After all, they have failed when they should have been successful. And one may be able to defend this if the investment logic were applicable. I think that in an age where you have more and more dynamic innovation processes, that is less and less the case. The opposing case, I told you I would give you two cases, is the innovation or discovery project. And that is what we typically teach our students for in entrepreneurship classes, innovation management, economics of innovation. And the logic here is very different, okay? There's a risky task. Nothing is clear. Nothing is set. Nothing is certain. Things might even be ambiguous or ambivalent. So application of statistics and so forth might get terribly, terribly difficult. So if you have a set of experiments that you can run, the task is then to find the approaches to the solution that work. But there are few. This is a risk structure, okay? Maybe 10% in venture capital environments of the set of projects will work out. So coming to a failure quickly is a good thing. Actually, people with coming to failure quickly may be rewarded and may be attractive employees for venture capitalists. So such a setting requires that a failure is tolerated, and in the organizational environment most suited for this particular context, we may call that a failure culture or leading culture. And there's talk about how we can take this country right now to a learning culture, not necessarily to a failure culture, because that sounds a little bit ambiguous. Okay. So the important insight here is that failure in this context doesn't tell you anything or very little about the capability of the manager or the person involved. It may tell you more about the risk structure of the underlying projects. And I'm applying that now to the projects that public sector employees are undertaking in the regulatory scene, in the devising of new policy instruments and so forth. So what I'm telling you right now is that we need something more experimental in this field, where failure is not immediately linked to personal slacking, non-performance, or whatever else. By the way, academics know this in disguise. Journals want to have statistically significant results from us. It would be much better if we sent to the journal an exact description of the research design and in a later stage sent the results after we have let the dice fall where the dice fall without trying to squeeze the results into significant territory. Now let's come to the Comptroller Generals, to the Rechnungshöfe and other controlling agencies, because those entities are deeply committed to viewing the world in terms of investment projects. I'm deeply convinced that most people in Rechnungshöfe don't understand the other logic, the growth logic, the innovation logic, or the opportunity logic. And that may have to do with socialization, and maybe because we are not talking enough about that. So we had to educate people about that, because otherwise there is very little foundation for experimental policymaking, as I'm trying to advocate it. So these organizations also typically insist on having metrics for about everything. And once you have metrics, people will measure, and then there's a behavioral response to that. By the way, this is also true for the private sector, and I have some evidence. I will not go into that, but I think that the rise of innovation controlling in established firms has in many instances led to the complete screening out of risky projects and to the now established division of labor between established firms and startups. So we squeezed the stuff out of the corporates, and that stuff had to go somewhere. There was money in it, so we took that in and left it for the startups. So this was a winding road. That led me to another point, which is I find that there has been considerable organizational failure in the past 10 years in the market. This is not the classical market failure. When the OEMs, the large automotive firms in this country, react very slowly to electrification, automated driving and other things, because they're well coordinated and they talk themselves into the superiority of the existing technologies and so forth, all things that have been covered in the organizational literature, nothing new for the audience here, okay, then that creates a failure, a delay that is visible to observers, even to observers in the sometimes boring public sector. Now, you may respond to that saying that ferment may come from startups, and I agree very much, and while I think very highly of market forces and startups and competition formats for arriving at good solutions, but there are pathologies in that sector as well, and I don't want to be silent about them. If you follow the new discussions in Silicon Valley about slow VC, soft VC, and so forth, then these are initiatives that are trying to take out the overly strong trend to acceleration and burning a lot of money in the experimental mode. So things can go wrong in the other domain as well. Now, if these firms and startups do not always perfectly align under the threat of competition or the power of competition, whatever you want to do with it, then there are tasks in the public sector arising, early truffle-finding exercises that may be taken up by organizations of DAPA style and so forth. We're getting a lot of these in Germany, and in Germany too, in France one, at the European level, at the EIC another one. So we're getting knee-deep into that, and that might be a good thing. Now, this is experimentation, and this is what I want to arrive at. What I want to give you is an argument, a pitch for more experimentation, for example, in regulation. We know that innovation is always ambivalent, always needs some form of regulation that guides it. Regulation, taken too seriously, can kill innovation, and a lack of proper regulation can lead to social disasters such as the one exemplified by Facebook and Cambridge Analytica. So we talk right now about appropriate regulation of AI, blockchain technologies, and others, to name just two. The top-down investment model approach to regulation is to think deeply about it, to think a year long about it, or maybe 2 years, and then come out with the perfect regulation. The experimental mode of doing that is to go into sandboxes and into real labor, or whatever you want to call it. So in that case, learning would be stepwise, incremental, and the results of that learning process may have to be undone on a regular basis as we go along. I think that in the presence of fast change, this form of developing regulatory frameworks, and by the way, new policy instruments, has vast advantages. And by the way, it's collaborative. It's not either public sector or market. It's both. There are many impediments to something like that. Let me give you a few. Fear of loss of control, ideological issues, political power, party membership, when public sector employees have party membership, allegiances, and so forth. These are all the classical reasons that you get as impediments to innovation in the private sector as well. And they are present there, and they build up barriers to changing things. So what I would like to point out to you is that when you think about the experimental mode, we have exercises that we can borrow from. And the most instructive exercise that I have seen is that software engineers have started about 15 to 20 years ago when they started to think about agile software development. And there's a very interesting document out there, which is the Manifesto for Agile Software Development, and you may expect now what's coming around the corner. That manifesto is based on principles and so forth. They read like, welcome changing requirements, even in late development. Deliver prototypes early. Have close daily cooperation between all involved. Projects are built around motivated individuals, have face-to-face conversation, have people in one location. Be simple, okay? And talk to your users. All things that are currently, I think, lacking a little bit when we develop new policies in the field of research and innovation. Or at least the cases in which we apply that are much less often and frequent than the cases in which we do not do that. So there are also certain values that are embedded in that individuals and interactions are valued over processes and tools, okay? Working prototypes or first drafts over comprehensive documentation, user collaboration over contracts and stuff like that. I don't want to go into that. At a research center that a few organizations in Munich have built, we have started to run our research processes in Scrum mode or Agile development mode, bringing all folks together every 2 or 3 weeks, having them talk about the research results all the time, and the results of that are very productive. So let me take that as an example. Let me conclude that I think we may need a manifesto of agile innovation policymaking. So a programmatic statement that emphasizes the experimental, the adaptive nature of innovation policies, of evaluation, and of regulatory intervention. A statement that acknowledges how limited long-range planning, foresight, and sophisticated strategies can be at any time, and how limited assessments of specialization advantages are when these advantages can be undone relatively quickly by electric mobility, artificial intelligence, and other means. Such a program would not be a substitute for all approaches we have developed already. They have served us well. But I think it would be a highly desirable and much needed concept to support the public sector in making contributions that market mechanisms cannot make, but which will also not be forthcoming in the snail pace model of public activity we're using today. Thank you.